Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Readiness Report with the Daily Maverick. And of course, this episode is brought to you by the Frederick Norman Foundation. We are having conversations. The world has turned upside down. There were clear signs that that's where we were going. But in some quarters, I wake up to news that even the Pentagon did not approve of the Israeli and U.S. strike on Iran, that they had no evidence, no reason to believe that Iran was about to strike. And of course, we know that has been Netanyahu's talking point for decades, telling us that Iran is a minute away, 10 minutes away, a year away, few months away from developing and unleashing a nuclear weapon. And there's a craziness around what's happening today because, you know, there was a program. Barack Obama crafted a program. Donald Trump dismantled it. So you are attacking a country for the for not having the very thing that was constituted with good success a couple of years ago. So there's a lot of things that are moving around, a lot of implications. There is a historical context as well. I can't help thinking about regime change as U.S. policy. It's not the first time that the U.S. would be entering Iran. 1953, the U.S. and Britain orchestrated a coup against Iran's democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, and it was all around oil and other matters as well. But there was a CIA-backed operation that removed a government chosen by the Iranian people and installed the Shah. And fast forward now, Iranians are caught between a rock and a hard place. Make no mistake, the supreme leader was authoritarian. Iran is in the category of authoritarian regimes. So Iranians don't want to live like that, but the alternative is not U.S. and Israeli imperialism and aggression. But anyway, to help me make sense of all of this, how did we get from a point where Oman indicated that Iran had agreed in principle to the framework on the table, Donald Trump in June claiming that those previous strikes had obliterated Iran's nuclear facilities. And then a couple of months later, no, Iran poses a threat, and then we've got to strike. What on earth is happening? Helping me make sense of this is my friend, Philip van Niekerk, and he joins me now. Welcome to the Readiness Report, Philip.
Hi, Reedy. Hi.
You sound down. What's happening?
Well, I mean, do I sound down? Okay.
You do.
The world.
There's a lot to be down.
The world
about.
Is down, I guess. You know, what does one say? I mean, you know, the thing is, these kind of wars, which we've seen in Iraq, which we've seen in Libya, you know, of intervention by the U.S., they start well, you know. I'm living through deja vu here. You know, the march on Baghdad was just a matter of days, really. But then they end very badly. They always end badly. And, you know, what we have is not necessarily any kind of roadmap or understanding of how it's going to turn out, but certainly a sense that there are a number of unintended consequences. And this time it's much worse because the world is a much more fragile place right now. I mean, we've got conflicts all the way around in East Africa. Also, Afghanistan is fighting Pakistan. And the overall sort of global sense right now is one of, you know, people are writing, you know, where are you going to be? This, by the way, South Africa is one of the safest places if it's going to be World War III. New Zealand is even safer, apparently. And, you know, the thing is that, yeah, everybody knew there was no imminent threat from Iran. In fact, I think when Netanyahu came to the White House a couple of weeks ago, he met with Trump, but they decided the date then that they were going to go for it. And irrespective of what was going on in the negotiations, and in fact, the opposite of a threat was true. I think that they calculated that Iran is weaker now than it's been in decades. You know, most of its allies, the so-called Ring of Fire, have been degraded or decapitated by Israel. The international situation is not favorable. It doesn't look like China or Russia is going to come in and help Iran. Apparently, MBS, the Saudis, were actually urging Trump to do it. Just, you know, get rid of these guys. And so, you know, far from being, you know, what Trump claims, this was about, which is about an imminent threat. It was, let's get them now while they're on their knees, while they're weak.
What was the use? What would be the US's strategic interest? I mean, Israel's interests are very clear, and we know that there is this umbilical connection between Israel and the US. What is the US looking to gain from this scenario?
You know, I think it's more to do with what is Trump looking to gain from this scenario, because I think when they talk about America first as being their kind of policy, both internally and in the world, it's really Donald Trump first. And I think that the whole situation in Iran is due to a lot of miscalculations that Trump has made on the basis that he pulled out of, in 2018, he pulled out of an agreement that Barack Obama had negotiated with the entire global community, the Russians and the Chinese, everybody was on board. And, you know, it was a good agreement. Everybody felt, except Netanyahu and the Republicans, or many of the Republicans in Congress. And Trump pulled out of that, not because it wasn't working or it was a bad deal, but because it was Obama's deal. And that, in a way, set the course for further down the line, where Iran suddenly starts to, you know, enrich uranium at much higher grades. And then you have October 2023, where Israel is effectively blaming Iran for being behind the attacks that came out of Gaza, unproven. But, you know, you've got a series of events that lead to Trump thinking, okay, this is my big moment. I'm going to be the guy who, you know, we've had a problem with Iran since 1979 when they overthrew the Shah and Jimmy Carter failed and then everybody else failed. And I'm going to be the guy who delivers Iran. And by the way, Cuba's next. So I don't see where the U.S. strategic interest lies in this. Iran was willing to make a deal. Iran basically, you know, and if you look at the core of that deal, what they were saying is, we'll give up in any, to all practical purposes, we'll give up any desire to build or make nuclear weapons or even enrich nuclear material. Mm-hmm. But we want the symbolic right. We have to maintain the symbolic right to say that we still have the right at some point in the future if we want to. And that was important because the nuclear deal, nuclear issue has become tied to some kind of sense of Iranian nationalism. And so what they wanted out of the negotiation is to be able to come away, you know, with a sense that at least they got something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if Trump had looked at that and understood the history of this place, he would have known this is a good deal. Go for it. You've got your opportunity. For the United States, that would have been a good deal. For Israel, that would have, for the region, it would have been a good deal. But no, they decided to embark on a war which is unconstitutional in terms of the United States, illegal in terms of international law, and which is destructive of the entire region. We've got a situation now where, you know, Dubai's airports are closed. There are, you know, it's one of the major aviation hubs of the world. You've got people in airports all over the world that are stuck. You've got skyscrapers on fire in Bahrain. Lebanon is now in the war. You've got Saudi Aramco getting hit this morning. And you've got, you know, and I come back to the thing that really, you know, kind of got me, which is, you know, 150 girls at a school, you know, were bombed.
But they're doing the typical thing that Israel does, where they say a faulty missile from Iran. I mean, within a minute, it's always like that. Even the killing of a colleague of mine, journalist, they deny it. They blame the other side. And then a couple of weeks later, when the truth comes out, nobody cares anymore. The point blank range annihilation shooting of paramedics, they denied it. They blamed the other side until a recording of one of their dead paramedics or medics was found. So even now, the framing of the bombing of the school is that it was the other side. But we see evidence and footage that it wasn't. And not only that, Philip, the irony of this, the moral turpitude of this, that you claim that you are going into Iran to liberate Iranians. Iranians don't want to be liberated by you bombing and killing their children. They talk about how women are so oppressed in Iran. True, true. So why is it that you would target a school where elementary school children are learning? You cannot bomb a nation into liberation. One would think that is obvious.
Yeah, I mean, I saw Trump yesterday. He was flying back from Mar-a-Lago. He did this whole thing from Mar-a-Lago, by the way. And he gets off the plane and he's saying, well, you know, we're going to just break, basically, Iran, break the regime, and then it's for the people. We're handing like a gift to the people, and it's a once-in-a-generation opportunity to go and take it. Of course, he knows nothing, understands nothing about Iran. The fact of the matter is that Iran is a very is not only an autocracy, as you pointed, it's been a very oppressive state. And if you look at what happened on the 7th to 9th of January this year, thousands of people were massacred by the Iranian security forces. But Iran is still a society that is deeply divided. Only 60% Persian. There are minorities, you know, who have other kind of interests attached to kind of some of the neighboring states. But within Iran, okay, so you've got an urban class of women and youths and people who are against the regime, but who are and have in essence been actually pro-American at least for the last generation or so. But then you've also got a lot of people, as we saw from the demonstrations. You know, there's a 40-day period of mourning for the Ayatollah, and you know, thousands and thousands of people have come out all over Iran. So don't tell me that they didn't have any support. It's clear, you know. I mean, look, in a way, Trump could look at his own country to understand what's going on there, because in many ways, I mean, the religious right is in control in Iran, and a lot of those people are cult followers. They're also, you know, deeply religious. And in many ways, it's kind of Iran's version of MAGA, you know. And then you've got a sort of a more metropolitan, urbanized, you know, group of people. But they don't, I'm quite sure. And here's the other thing, you know, when they went to the streets in early January, Trump was saying, go to the streets. We've got your back. And then when the massacres and the slaughter happened, America wasn't there. They weren't doing anything. And again, I mean, you know, here we have a situation where you're saying, go on, go to the streets. And what are you going to do from your aerial bombers, you know, to stop the fact that, you know, there's a very deeply entrenched system of Basiji, local Gestapo or whatever, who are going to take out people who go to the streets? You know, what are you going to do to protect them? Because you haven't put boots on the ground to, you know, to start to dismantle that infrastructure. You know, all you've done is just bombed from the sky.
Yeah. I'm thinking about, I mean, it's the same principle, different dynamics. When the United States started this kind of disinformation, maybe let me not say the United States, it came specifically from the White House, Donald Trump, and some of the MAGA elements in the right in South Africa. You found people rallying around the brand of South Africa, the state. I certainly did, not because we are public relations officers, but because the white genocide and everything else was based on a lie. Right. So if we are acting on truth and lies, that was the purpose of that. So I'm trying to say that reasonable people tend to rally around what is truthful. They tend to protect their home, in this case, their country, against the, you know, the toxic impact of lies. So just extending that to what may possibly happen in Iran, we agree the Iranian regime deeply repressive. There's no debate there. The crackdowns of dissent, suppressing opposition, we know all about that. But the question I want to ask is, does foreign military aggression weaken authoritarian regimes or entrench them by rallying nationalism under external threat? So the external threat becomes even more overwhelming and you could actually achieve the opposite. What is likely to happen here?
No, I quite agree with you. And I mean, Trump doesn't really have a plan. I think he must have been, you know, basically high on what happened in Venezuela. You could define that as regime change. What you do is you kidnap the president and you take him out and you do a deal with the vice president, and it's all nice, and then you get Venezuela's oil as well. Iran is a deeply complicated society, and the current regime is deeply entrenched. I mean, they've made plans that you take out the top layer of leadership, which they did in the first few hours of this attack, mm-hmm. but then you've got a second layer, and then you've got a third layer, and then you've got a fourth layer. So the concept of regime change, you know, somehow that doesn't seem to work. I saw Trump yesterday arguing, you know, oh, well, you know, they've been in touch with me and, you know, now we can talk. Well, talk about what? You know, clearly he's looking for an off-ramp, but his off-ramp, you know, is determined by two things, either that the regime decides they're going to capitulate, which is not going to happen, or the people go to the streets in such numbers, you know, that, you know, there becomes a popular revolution, and that's not happening either. So, you know, what are you left with then? You don't have a plan. You know, the possibility of Iran collapsing and that we have another situation like Iraq or Syria, where, you know, massive conflict kind of follows, new organizations emerge, new forces arise, and the entire Middle East is destabilized. That is a kind of very, very worrisome reality that we face at this point.
Yeah. I just want to talk about I just want to go back to the implications. Let me ask this. I just saw a post this morning that Trump reportedly said that they didn't just kill the supreme leader, that the alternative number one, the supreme leader is dead, of course. And then senior Iranian leadership figures have been killed as well. And he said that even the alternative number two, number three, number four were killed. And I thought, from a geopolitical strategy, from a military strategy, that is just dumb. It's like being on the plane, killing the pilot and not having anyone to take over. I mean, why would a world leader admit to something like that, that we killed the guy that we wanted to kill, but even our options have now been killed? What does that all mean?
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. But of course, it's also wrong, because there's a very deep bench within Iran, and some of the prime movers, people who've actually been directing the negotiations and actually directing the crackdown on the demonstrators, people like Ali Larijani, are still very much in power. So they've taken out the Ayatollah, but they changed the start of the onslaught of the attack, because they discovered, Israeli intelligence discovered, that they were all in one place earlier in the day. And they said, okay, opportunistically, let's go, boom, let's kill them all. And they did, they killed a lot of people. But, you know, they have very little understanding of how deeply entrenched this regime is, and how many other, kind of leaders are willing to step up. Israel should know that. Yeah, sorry.
How is this going to affect the region? Already you see the chasm, some Gulf states, some Middle East states, really pushing back against Iran, saying that Iran is the one that violated, the trust, as it were. But if you've got U.S. bases in those countries, then that's what is going to happen. And then we woke up to news that there was a mistaken shooting down of U.S. Is it military? What do you call the planes? What do you call them? That it was shot down.
F-15s. Yeah.
F-15s. So what does that mean in terms of how other players in the region are positioning themselves in this conflict?
Well, the one thing that I was a little bit surprised by, the Washington Post reported yesterday that the Saudis had actually urged Trump to go ahead with this operation, while putting out publicly that they were pleading for peace and let's not go to war. So the problem with the Gulf states, you've got Bahrain, you've got the United Arab Emirates, you've got Kuwait, is they've got their host, in Qatar, they host these U.S. bases. But the kind of quid pro quo for that is that the U.S. sort of guarantees their security. And I think what Iran has chosen to do by attacking the Gulf states is to essentially tear away that United States security curtain. And mm-hmm. that's where the U.S. is vulnerable, because I think those countries are going to be potentially reassessing their relationship with the United States further down the road, particularly yes. if this thing evolves into the kind of mess that we all fear, which mm-hmm. it might well do if Trump does not pull back.
Just a short reflection on how the markets are reacting. I see, you know, oil surging so significantly in a single move, a sign of fear, right? And the fragility. But gold, a safe haven, they're running to safety. Gold is a safe haven, so we are good for that. But oil price increases are going to come, and they're very bad. That's bad for us as South Africa, right? As an importer, right?
No, it is. And it's bad for the markets as a whole. I understand that the Strait of Hormuz, which 20% of global oil passes through every day, I think that that's still open, despite the fact that Iran said they're closing it. But the bombing of the Saudi Aramco facility this morning, I think that has certainly kind of shaken the markets, and it's going to continue to kind of spiral upwards unless there's some kind of halt put to the fighting. So I think we're going to feel pain at the pump, so to speak.
I do want to ask, Philip, that, you know, Trump came in as the peace president, that he's going to end all the wars. And many people who voted for him were voting for him for that reason. He used to attack Barack Obama, that Obama is going to attack Iran for political mileage and expediency. And he just, fast forward a couple of years ago, he does exactly what he's been accusing Barack Obama of. How is this likely to play domestically? We do know the volatility of the U.S. electoral cycle, as it were. You can't catch your breath. You had an election in 2024. It ushered in Donald Trump. They're busy preparing for the midterms, another election in 2 years. All the dynamics that Congress is supposed to sign off on a war, that some of the friends of the United States are saying this war is against international diktats. And domestically, you have the America First crowd that doesn't want a war. Iraq is still uppermost in Afghanistan, still uppermost in the consciousness or the memory of so many people so many Americans who suffered losses. What do Americans want? How are they likely to position themselves on this one?
Yeah, well, look, first of all, the vast majority of Democrats have come out against the war, which is very unusual because, you know, if you go back to Iraq, there was more or less bipartisan support. There were people on the fringes who were against it. You've got a very powerful op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this morning by Tim Kaine, who's a very much a moderate Democrat, saying, you know, this is unconstitutional, this is uncalled for completely. You've got Ro Khanna bringing in a resolution into Congress this week to basically calling on them to stop the war, but also to put the Republicans on record, who are very, very quiet about this whole thing. And then you've got, you know, AOC and Bernie, you know, with a much stronger, in a way, position. But then you've got the MAGA, with Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, who's now no longer in the House, saying, you know, come on, you know, what is this about? You know, and Tucker Carlson saying this is, you know, this is a complete betrayal of what we were supposed to be about. By the way, I saw a video just now of the wife of a serviceman, you know, telling Trump, this is on you. What are you doing? Why did you do this? You know, and I think that the war starts out with a very low favorability. I think it was like 34% in favor. And, you know, it might go up because initially the Republicans will rally. The MAGA might very well rally because it's Trump doing it and he's saying that this is great. And they hit all these guys on day one. But I can't see it getting to majority support because I think the American people are sick and tired of these kind of wars. And and the only question is, what are the mechanisms available to kind of hem him in, you know? And I think there's a bigger issue, which is the complete willingness to dispense with any sense of rule of law. You know, it's like, I, Donald Trump, will decide. I will decide to invade this country. I will decide to break. And that's what is really the break with the post-1945 world. It's a complete destruction of the idea that there's some kind of international law that restrains people. Even George Bush, and I was completely against the Iraq war. Even George Bush went to the United Nations to try and make his case.
But there was some pretense at
Glenn Powell out, and later, you know, where he did get support from the Security Council. So, you know, there was an acknowledgement that this thing existed, that you can't just, you know, go to war at a whim, at one man's whim. And I think what we've got here were two man's whim, Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. And the trouble is, you've got such a powerful military force that the US has now. And sitting at the top of this military force is what? You know, what is this? What is this doctrine? What does this represent in terms of, you know, humanity? This is Donald Trump's ego, Donald Trump's power, and also, you know, the money of his, you know, his cronies. You know, really, on Friday, we were texting about this. And I think I texted you. I said, look, I'm watching the prediction markets. And there was suddenly a surge for the notion that Khamenei would be out of office by July the 1st. In other words,
and here we are.
A few hours later, he's dead. So people were making money on that. People were
The betting markets were surging.
The betting markets were surging. They you know, and that as well kind of like sticks in, you know, the craw. That's a very, very kind of corrupt way of going about international relations.
Yeah, no, it was so obscene, you know, making amounts of that people are having this kind of conversation. Is it going to happen? Is it not? But anyway, Philip, there's so many layers. And as usual, we are so grateful for you sharing your insights and helping us understand this madness a little better. Thanks for joining us on the Readiness Report.